Welcome back to the Scarlet Thread Society. As always, this is your host, Taz, coming at you with a little advice before we get started. Lock your doors, close your windows, cover your mirrors, and buckle up. This is going to be a wild one. We already had the ghost in the machine try to interfere with us once. So, buddy, why don't you try introducing yourself again? We'll see if it takes this time.
Yeah, Lord willing. Hello, Paws, and everyone. It's me, Doc Brown. I'm a PhD academic, or at least let's say post-academic, specializing in Reformation history, and I'm a great lover of all things strange and weird.
Very good. And what are you here to talk about tonight?
Well, you were so generous as to let me drop this idea on you and hopefully others, and hopefully people find it at least interesting. It's this theory I've been working on for a few months now that, the Reformation period, the early modern period in European history is super cyberpunk. That's my theory. And I think I can back it up.
Well, I think we've got quite a hook there. So where does it start?
I guess let's maybe just give a quick working definition of cyberpunk, I guess. I tend to go more to the literary side of it as opposed to like the video games or the movies, movie side of it. William Gibson's one of my favorite authors, wrote Neuromancer, the whole Sprawl trilogy, many other books. He has this great quote, which I'm certain you pause now, but I'll say it here, that the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. That was sort of like a little brain worm. It's been a brain worm for many years, ever since I read that and read his works. And I was thinking, too, about, the another working definition of cyberpunk I've heard that, it's a high tech, low life. And I was like, wow, like that is actually like the Reformation is like this weird, like combination of high tech, printing finally getting spread out, banking, finance systems spreading out, firearms happening, all this like crazy tech happening. But then you get this kind of like, low life, maybe in the sense, not necessarily of criminal activity, although you do get a fair amount of that. Well, I'm certain we'll get into some of the crazy shit that happened during the Reformation, but this kind of just insane law, kind of, law breaking, breaking of the norms, breaking of the rules, mentality combined with, a more even distribution of the tech that had been sort of building up in the Middle Ages. And I mean, I think, I think if we accept those things, then the early modern period, the Reformation, is very cyberpunk, very cyberpunk.
Very cyberpunk indeed. So you've got a background in the period. For those who aren't caught up on their conventional history, let alone their unconventional history, what exactly are we talking about in terms of era here? And what exactly was going on that allows you to make this argument? We referenced the technological changes But what sort of technologies are coming into play, and why are they what determines that this thesis is valid?
That's a very good question. There's this, if you were to like, you might remember from high school history class, right? If they even teach this anymore, you kind of learn that like, oh, Martin Luther, wrote 95 theses and nailed it on a church door. And all of a sudden we had modernity. Obviously that's not how it happened.
Actually exactly what Catholics think though, isn't it?
It is actually. The Reformation, I think, is really a time where, starting in like the late 14, starting really in the 1400s and then really taking off in the 1500s with people like Luther, you kind of have like the pressure cooker of the Middle Ages finally sort of explodes. And so there's a lot of things going on in terms of tech. If you expand technology, not just to like physical technology, but maybe like metaphysical technology, you have things happening before the Reformation, it's in the West, it's all Catholic. So large parts of Catholic Europe are undergoing a huge change. Like the Italian city-states pioneer the ability to, transmit value, monetary value over distances, the foundations of the modern banking system, which allows, really kind of, I think you can make an argument, the creation of a more modern sense of money as opposed to an older, more like early medieval sense of wealth. This, I would argue, allows for sort of new fortunes to be made and for perhaps more solidified political structures to be weakened. You can think about the papacy in particular as it pertains to the Reformation later. As sort of, whatever you want to call that, the Renaissance in the Mediterranean moves north. Right, you get sort of more the Germanic speaking peoples start to be exposed to ideas, surround humanist ideas, sort of this drive to go back to the sources of texts, the whole ad fontes movement. I know I'm jumping around here, but I think you can follow. With the expansion in things like trade networks, I know you've talked about that previously on the show, monetary networks, you get the sort of there's opportunity for new physical and metaphysical kind of realms to be created. With the explosion of printing and printing getting much cheaper, obviously, this is a way to directly influence what people think. Information technology really is no longer just monks copying manuscripts. It's not the church that gets to decide what's printed, although obviously the church wields a huge amount of power in that. But you get, anyone with enough balls in a printing press can kind of print what they want. So it's a very chaotic time. Technology is advancing in ways that no one is really able to, that people are having to react to as opposed to plan. And again, like I said, the Reformation doesn't come out of nowhere. There's lots of, real or perceived abuses of the church. This is not a theology podcast. I won't get into that, but, people are upset about what's going on in the Western church. And, there's, pestilence, plague, you got the ever-present threat of the Turks, the Ottomans, doing stuff, messing with people, attacking places. And so it's just this crazy time. And the things that, people kind of maybe held to previously, things that felt certain or stable, don't feel so stable anymore. And the technology is there allowing people to, rightly or wrongly, right, maybe a little bit of both, sort of take advantage of the uncertainty of the times and do kind of wild shit. So, to me, that really feels cyberpunk. I mean, that like you that's might not be data heists, on the net, but you might be trying to, maybe you're trying to just take back the monasteries in your lands. If you want to think about like what happened in England, or maybe you want to just, completely change the way people view their relationship to the church or to God. I mean, like as it happened more with Luther. So anyhow, that's sort of my pitch.
So there's that half of it. But now I guess I don't know if this was in the crashed prior recording or if we already addressed it here too. We talked about the quote being high tech, low lives, right?
Yep.
So that's the high tech. Where does the low lives come in?
Well, you know, anybody, anytime there's an opportunity, you'll get opportunists taking advantage of it. And, you know, and being an opportunist is not necessarily a bad thing. I'm kind of on Luther's side. I think that there, he saw what was going on. He saw the ability to perhaps try to make a change. Obviously there was no guarantee that he would succeed in that. Almost killed several times. So, you know, that's maybe not low life. Obviously I'm more on Luther's side, but it is, it's not low life necessarily. And I think he's doing a bad thing, but it's low life in that he's willing to undercut the current legal and ecclesiastical structures. That is kind of like a low life thing to do. If you want to, expand out the concept of low life a bit there. I mean, the church definitely saw him as a heretic and as a villain and as a criminal. And in some ways, I mean, he's acting like one more out of necessity, right? Luther never really wanted to fracture the church. He wanted to reform the church. At some point that becomes clear to him that that's not possible. He has to run away and hide, right? Taking on the moniker of Junker Jörg and pretending to be a knight and, you know, being secreted between different, noble houses and stuff like that. So even the, you know, the heroes, quote unquote heroes of the Reformation have, a lot of them have kind of this, you know, a sneaky underhanded side to them, really more out of necessity, I think, just because they don't want to be burned. They don't want to be killed horribly for their ideas. At the same time though, because of sort of, again, the pressure cooker of the Middle Ages really starting to pop off, you have people just taking advantage of the sort of this growing lack of faith in the structures of society. A great example of this, or maybe a sad example of this, are the various Anabaptist revolts and rebellions that you get, during Luther's lifetime. You get the German Peasants' Revolt, which then later, after Luther dies, becomes sort of an inspiration to others to do things like in Münster in Germany, there's the Münster Rebellion, where, roaming groups of essentially armies of peasants go around and claim that the kingdom of God is here. And therefore we need to, you know, throw down every single ruler, every single landowner. Now, you know, your land belongs to us, kind of really proto communist movements. So that's also pretty low life, right? Like there's this shakeup that happens.
Nothing says punk like Calvinism, right?
Yeah, exactly. Nothing says punk like a predestination. Yeah. So yeah, there's a fair amount of low, you know, skullduggery happening at the same time. And the technology, I mean, whether people are noticing it at the time, looking back, right, from our, you know, armchair positions now, you can see how the tech is allowing these movements to happen, whether they be good or bad, and then how people in the moment are creating, better distribution networks for printed materials, getting support, right? Like if you think about like the Protestant regions of Germany or German speaking Europe at the time, there's this mad dash, right, to get in on the whole, you know, Protestant project. There's the nobility that supports the Protestants, maybe not for the most noble reasons. They can see that there's maybe some more control to be had, and if we could just get out, not have to worry so much about what the Pope says or what about the Roman Church says, we might have some more control. And then there's the nobility that rejects that and wants to stay loyal to Rome. And it's like a informational arms race, in a way. And obviously, you know, well, maybe not obviously, spoiler, you know, culminates in 30 years of just massive bloodshed in the 30 Years' War. So ended finally by the Peace of Westphalia. So, but yeah, there's
like to cut in on what you were saying there a little bit. Do you think that there was a significant number of actors there who understood really what was going on and the implications of what was happening around them? Or do you think most of it was cynical moment by moment power plays? I suppose specifically framed in reference to the German nobility, without whom, you know, a lot of this wouldn't have been possible in the first place.
That's a very good question. I think I don't subscribe to the total cynical view. And I think it's, I think two things can be true at the same time, right? I think German nobility that support the ones that support the Protestants or end up supporting the Protestants, I think many of them actually do have, in their minds, right? In their minds, they have legitimate grievance with Rome because again, there's this, you know, the amount of money that's being, in their minds, right, like siphoned away from, well, from them, but also from German-speaking Europe to do things like support papal armies and to build, you know, large building projects in Rome. Those are legitimate concerns. I think anyone, I mean, I try to put myself in their shoes. I think I'd be a little pissed too. At the same time, right, the way you hold power is to you know, keep a pulse on, or keep a finger to the pulse of the times, and to keep track of what's going on. And if you see an opportunity, I mean, and you're already pretty disgruntled, I don't know, I think you probably would take it. So that's not a great answer. And it's a little bit of a yes, both, but I think history a lot of times is a little bit of, you know, it's always a couple different, or maybe many different motivations that are driving people to make the decisions they make. But no, I don't subscribe to the completely cynical view that, like, you know, that they didn't care at all about Reformation ideals. You wouldn't sacrifice, you wouldn't threaten or risk your life and your property that way if you didn't at least care a little bit about it, I think.
Now, we'll circle back to the Reformation.
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to sort of advance into the next part of the thesis you handed me.
Okay.
You talked about how the Reformation was fundamentally cyberpunk, even if people don't necessarily view it that way. And then you made the case to me that we're living in an era of a sort of disenchanted cyberpunk.
Yep. Yeah. I think what I had said is that something like Reformation was fully enchanted cyberpunk. So there's all this, you know, it is the beginning of the modern period. There's many of the hallmarks of the modern period, things like, a plurality, maybe not religious diversity per se, but a plurality of religions practiced in one area in Europe. That's a thing. The creation of nation states, all these things are coming into fruition or are coming really kind of finally emerging from the womb. At the same time, though, at least in the mindset of most people, the world is fully enchanted still. God is in heaven. The devil is in hell. Angels are everywhere. Devils are everywhere. Right. There's this technological revolution happening, but that doesn't mean that, like, you know, you might not find a witch out in the woods who might put a spell on you. Right. These things are all coexisting. You know, I think it's pretty safe to say with the, you know, in our current era, we live in a cyberpunk present too. I think that's pretty, I don't think anyone's going to really fight me too much on that. But there's this, you know, as maybe epitomized by the new atheist movement, there's this blind trust in technology now. We gladly give up our humanity to the machine. But there's never this moment where we stop and think, but maybe, you know, is there a witch out in the woods somewhere? Is there a devil in this machine that might do something to me? We don't have those categories of things that go bump in the night anymore. We don't even have categories for things that transmit virtue, like, you know, saints or angels. or that, you know, there's a war going on behind the scenes. We just, you know, have kind of deluded ourselves into thinking that, you know, that the technology, the cyberpunk technology is inherently neutral, and it will just, there's nothing bigger or beyond it. And, you know, we live in that sort of fantasy. Although at the same time, and I think I mentioned this to you when we were talking about it, that I do see, even in the past few years, kind of a reemergence of a re-enchanted cyberpunk mindset. That, and so I think one of the things I had tossed out is that one of the ideas I had tossed out to you is that that I think we are entering a re-enchanted cyberpunk period. Because again, in this definition of cyberpunk, it's a very broad definition, but it kind of stands in for modernity in a way. I think cyberpunk actually is a better descriptor of modernity than the word modernity. And I really do think we're entering a re-enchanted period where people are starting to see how things like social media really are almost like spirits that drive people to do certain things. And so that's a rediscovery, I think, for a lot of people. And I think that if we look back at the early modern period, the Reformation in particular, we can get some insights, maybe a little bit of cautionary tales here and there, maybe, you know, things to start prepping for, because it's we also live in a wild time. So
now, before we work backwards and go through some of that content that you just referenced, I would love it if you could, for me, speculate wildly on how we got here and why you think the re-enchantment is happening now. Why did it become necessary? And like I said, why now?
I think we got here because of technology, because of techne, you know, because of the spirit of technology, the spirit of, you know, humans have always been good at tinkering with things, creating things. But obviously not really ever understanding the full implications of what we create, usually. I think technology, you know, in the early modern period specifically, there's this explosion of new technology, but there's still this understanding that technology is magic, right? There was still this belief that, right, like, you know, a mill that can you can grind a grain in, you harnessing the power of a river or a stream, that's pretty damn magical, right? Like, you're harnessing the power of water, a primal element, to grind, you know, grain. That's magical. And you can sit there and you can figure out why exactly it works and how it works and how to build a better mill. And, you know, or you could be like in the Netherlands, you could have a windmill. Okay, well, then you're harnessing the power of the wind. There was still something of an earlier idea that was riding alongside the scientific knowledge that was growing in the time period that this is science, but it's also kind of like magical. It's supernatural, right? That doesn't necessarily make it evil. Maybe we're harnessing the power of God's creation, right, to make our lives better. Well, geez, that's probably God maybe wants that for us. Okay, that's good, right? But there was still this understanding that there was something bigger and beyond us that was making the technology work. I think where we're at now, or where we've been up until pretty recently, is in a place where the technology works so damn good, we didn't really have to worry about why it was working. You know, like the computer runs and the car starts. And so that's great. And it makes my life, you know, at least in some ways, better, easier. You know, well, geez, life expectancy goes up. Geez, I guess that's great. Like, we have we have food to eat. This is amazing. And we start kind of the technology becomes, in a way, maybe the end as opposed to the means. But to I think where we're at now is where the technology has become so incredibly pervasive and it's not just that it's pervasive, but it's the speed with which technology is improving, or at least advancing, is exponential. And because it's exponentially expanding, we start to notice it more and more and more and more. And it gets to the point where you kind of can't pretend like there's not, like the technology itself maybe isn't driving us as opposed to us driving the technology. And I think in some ways it's just easier, at least for me, it's easier to conceptualize things like social media and the effect social media has on every aspect of our life, if you start viewing social media as some sort of entity in and of itself that maybe is couched inside larger trees of technological entities. And from there, you're pretty much, you're almost back to a early modern or even a pre-modern mindset of how the world works, where you are just in the chain of being, and God is at the top in heaven, and the devil's in hell at the bottom, and we are here, you know, and we are, there's a great battle for what's going on. So that's, maybe I've answered your question there.
Now, as I'm sure you're aware, that is a line of thinking that I have been on for a good number of years now. And
oh yeah, I'm sitting at the foot of the master here today, so
I don't know about that. I'm just a guy who's curious about that stuff. I want to ask on a more personal note, have you always been of that sort of disposition, or did you personally have a clarifying moment that brought you to that way of thinking?
Totally clarifying moment. So I have not always been, I will not pretend to have always had this mindset. No, no. The past 4 years, however we want to say that, has really made this clear to me. During things like lockdowns, the speed with which I could see ideas jump between people, and people that I knew and trusted completely changed their attitude towards me based on attitudes I had. I mean, like it was clear that it was from, like, I could even track it down to like this single post online that convinced that person, which was very disorienting for me because I started to see how, ideological possession kind of happens. Now, obviously that's been always going on. Humans have always been having this issue of, you know, mimetic infection. But to really see it so quickly and hit so many people simultaneously, I was like, I can't pretend that this isn't something outside, right? That's influencing us as humans.
It did seem unusually virulent, didn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Which then, I mean, and so that took me a few years to process. Like, I could see what was happening. I could see that it was permanently changing people around me, like actual people I knew, not just random, you know, anons online, but real people that I could know, like, oh, that person I know is now a completely different person because of this. That was disorienting and very upsetting, right? Because as humans, we all like to think that we have control over the world, but we really don't. And you know, there's the temptation, at least for me, I have a Luddite side. I kind of want to like pull back a little. I want to kind of, you know, maybe all technology is bad, ooh, but you know, that's how the world is. It's just so pervasive that where I'm at right now is something like, you know, we live in a cyberpunk world. We can't get away from it. So let's be as virtuous as we can as we use technology, because there are spirits behind it, whether they be good or bad. Right. So that's kind of where I'm at with it. That was a little bit of my experience of, you know, awakening to this reality.
I think it's safe to say the same would be true for a great many people too. Recent events, the last approximately 3.5-4 years, I think, have been greatly clarifying for a lot of people. Even if they don't come to the same conclusions as us, it feels like the sort of moment a generation turns on, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think some generations will be left in the dust, and some generations will adapt and adjust. And I mean, obviously, I want people to adapt and adjust, right? And you do too. We want them to make the shift needed, the shift in worldview that at least clarifies some things.
Oh, yes. That specifically and explicitly is the whole reason I do this here. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you believe yourself that we would still be on pace for this shift if we hadn't had events like we have?
I don't think, I mean, so if you mean that, like, would people be awakening, would more and more people be coming to this conclusion?
That's precisely what I'm saying without saying it. Yeah.
No, I think actually, I'm not glad things of the past, you know, 3.5-4 years have gone the way they have, obviously, but, the Ouroboros has to eat its own tail at some point. And I think that this is what happens when you reach for one too many gummy bears, right? You stretch just a little too far. But that is the nature of evil, right? To be bent back in on itself. And so, no, I think that this is actually a totally unintended consequence. But I think it's a good thing, right? It's a good thing that obviously the damage that was done, well, is done, and that's a tragedy, all of it. But the white pill is that I think is realizing that I'm not alone in this realization, that there's been others such as yourself who've come to this realization much earlier. And then also in my own life to see like people in my day-to-day life, maybe, you know, not end up where you and I are at, but end up a little bit closer to us. That fills me with a lot of hope. So
with all that in mind, I want to now go right back to where we started so the audience can chew on that a little bit. Let's get into the other half of what we were sort of discussing as we decided we wanted to do this.
Yeah.
Just tell me a little bit more about your specialty, some of the weird and wacky stuff of the Reformation and the early modern period.
Yeah. So the thing that I wrote my dissertation on was sort of the interplay between what the church taught, whether that would be, you know, the church in the Catholic regions, or, you know, the Lutheran church in Lutheran regions. So the official church doctrine and what people actually did on the ground. So actual lived religion. And there was usually a big kind of gap between those two things, which is fascinating. You get all sorts of like weird stuff happening, such as, one of the things, at least on paper, that Luther sought to reform in the Western Church was, let's maybe say, an overemphasis on devotion to saints. And so much to the point where, you know, the devotion to Christ is perhaps a little obscured. And so that's, you know, and you get various levels of critique, right? You have, you know, the Anglicans and Lutherans who tend to be a little bit more, you know, hey, saints are good guys, but like, hey, you know, you really shouldn't be putting them above Christ, right? Like, Christ is the one who reconciles us to God. And like, let's not forget that. Then you get even more extreme takes, such as Calvinists, who are like, you know, hey, like all of this stuff regarding saints is all idolatry. It's all magic. It's all evil superstition. We must do away with all of it. You know, please smash all your beautiful churches and replace them with more boring churches. So there's various flavors of this attitude. So that's like kind of what, you know, many Protestant churches were officially propagating. But on the ground, you get all sorts of weird stuff. Like there were these several images, pictures, drawings of Luther that were supposedly miraculous and could be used to, you know, stop houses from burning down or even like repel Catholic troops from that Protestant area of Germany. And so it's interesting, like people would just, you know, you remove sort of the more Catholic sacramental life, at least officially, but people instantly find something new to kind of pull in to allow them to, you know, help keep evil at bay and help keep the good in. So that's a lot of what I was looking at in my research, is how kind of like the disconnect between official church teaching and what people actually did. The Luther picture is just a ridiculous example. That's just fun, like miraculous, unburnable Luther pictures. Everyone needs one in their house. Do you know where I can get one?
I wish I did, because I'd have one for myself too.
Oh yeah.
Now, as you wrote that dissertation, what conclusion did you end up coming to? Is this just sort of a matter of cultural drag, where entrenched habits and mannerisms aren't necessarily keeping up with the theological shift around them? Or You know, just tell me a little bit more about how that turned out for you.
My thesis is something like, the Protestants, regardless of how much they might have thought they were doing away with, quote unquote, right, the quote unquote superstitions of the Roman Church, really were operating in the same world, not maybe not the same worldview per se, but in the same kind, they had the same kind of concepts at play. They were still living in, again, a fully enchanted world where everything around you was spiritually alive. I mean, a great example of this is Luther himself, his continual battles with the devil. Luther suffered from, we probably think it was Crohn's disease, unfortunately. So he had a very hard time with, you know, going to the bathroom and things like that. And he wrote all these strange journal entries about being tempted by the devil while on the toilet. And like him having to throw, there's the famous inkwell that he throws, or ink bottle that he throws at the devil, constant references to demonic forces, you know, pestering him, surrounding him. And that's like Luther, right? Like one of the main dudes behind the Reformation. He still lives in a world that's completely full of spirits. It's only really in like the late 1700s that you get the shift away from that kind of a worldview, that you get this more scientific, very logical understanding of how the world works, that really more coincides, I think, more with the Enlightenment than it does with the Reformation. So if there, you know, thesis is something like the Protestants, the early Protestants thought they were real different from the Catholics, but not really. And I think that there's actually a lesson in that for us, in that I think they still understood that the world is very enchanted. And I think when you start to forcefully purge your worldview of anything beyond science, I mean, look at what we have. We have the world we live in today. So
an empty husk of chemical food.
Yeah, pretty much. Yep. So
I suppose what I wanted to ask, or I wanted to get at next, we can look back at that now and realize that maybe they weren't so different from the other guys anyways. And this is something that I personally spend a lot of time thinking about, so this is a little bit more of a personal topic. Audience, bear with me if you're just not into this. But I find a lot of times when I have these discussions on social media with people, whether it's recorded or not, we end up in this spot where I'm constantly saying, well, I don't agree with the Catholics about all of this stuff, but at the same time, I'm going to have to take their side here on X, Y, Z, whatever, because the other one is some sort of Redditoid, or a Brainworms Baptist, or a million other things. So I guess what I really am getting at and wanting to ask you is, in your opinion, how far does the apple fall from the tree?
You mean how off are...
I guess, like, so let me reframe with a little less intentional ambiguity. Just how far do you think the gap between Lutheranism and Catholicism is currently, has been historically, and what do you think the implication of the difference, if any, is?
That's a good question. And thanks for putting up with my autism there. I had to actually hear it. I think the difference has always been played up more. And I think by both sides, by the way, I'm not calling out, I mean, Lutherans and Catholics have always played up the differences more. There are real differences. I'm not going to push those aside, but, like you're saying, if you compare, you know, you take a Lutheran who actually believes, right, and you get a Catholic who actually believes, they have so much more in common with each other than everyone else who's not, you know, not Christian, but even just other Christians too. I've always found a lot of commonalities with my Catholic friends, even when we get into deep and nitpicky theological discussions. even in the areas where we disagree, I think we disagree almost. It's like we disagree for the same reason, if you know what I mean. Like we disagree, but it coming out of the same intuition. So I think that the differences, while notable and obviously historically very notable, I think have always been played up a little bit more because of political realities of the time. I think now living in a largely post-Christian West, where you don't have the same sort of confessional allegiances and vying for control and power, I think, I mean, maybe this is me being a little pie in the sky, but I think maybe we can even find even more similarities and commonalities. And I think we probably should, because there's a lot of people out there who are so memetically infected with whatever it is that's going through them that, and they want to eat us. So that's kind of my take on it. So, yeah.
So in the interest of not boring the audience to death with these things that I would rather be talking about, perhaps you use the turn of phrase there, pie in the sky. And I believe you had also referenced in our research materials some strange lights or sky object stories.
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to relate those to us a little bit?
I will. Yeah. So one of the, this is why I love studying this time period, because you get, so during the Lutheran Reformation, there's a pretty good argument out there by a historian named Robin B. Barnes that the areas of Germany that were more likely to officially become Lutheran were those areas of Germany where there was a widespread belief in astrology. And that might seem very strange, particularly to anyone who might be Lutheran. but I always remind people that Philip Melanchthon, who is notable for having codified Luther's thought in like the Augsburg Confession, was himself an astrologer, and was known for compiling all manners of predictions based on heavenly body movements. And I think the argument holds. There was a widespread belief that God's plan was visible in stars, and that if something strange was moving around the sky, whatever that thing was, whether it was a comet, a constellation moving, various planets coming in and out of phase, that wasn't necessarily magical. In like the bad sense for people, that was seen as, in the early modern period, was seen as evidence of God's plan unfolding. Lights in the sky were actually a big part of, not the official way that the churches tried to spread the Reformation, but it was definitely on the ground with the everyday people was a big reason why at least certain people decided to side with the Protestants, because they could, in their minds, right, rightly or wrongly, in their minds, portentous events were happening. A comet is flying across the sky. Something is changing. Maybe this finally means the church will be cleansed of its unrighteousness, however they were conceptualizing it. So yeah, the strange objects in the sky, lots of those things are happening. Lots of reports of this going on. Always connected to strange occurrences like cows being born with three heads and weird stuff. So yeah, there's always been UFOs, I guess, right? And there's always been people looking to the skies.
Perfect chance for me to bring up something I'd kind of been sitting on, something I wanted to spring on you. Are you familiar at all with Jacques Vallée?
A little bit, yes, a little bit.
One of the kings of the UFO field. One of his great many books is a thorough and comprehensive search for what he could find and identify as UFO sightings throughout history. And I was surprised at just how many there were that cropped up through the late, middle, and early modern ages across Germany. The stories of flaming ships sailing through the sky, and things of that nature. So I was half wondering if you weren't going to bring up some of those stories, and that doesn't seem to be the direction you went with it. I'm not disappointed or anything. I'm not. But I was kind of hoping you'd get there.
I will add that to my, that's going to the top of my reading list, though. I didn't know that Valet had had done an extensive study of that. But yeah, I would not surprise me in the least if Robert Barnes's work surrounding a popular belief in astrology in the Reformation does not at least coincide in region to Valet's research there. It would not surprise me at all if the regions where Valet is, you know, noting that people are seeing strange things in the sky are those same regions where popular astrological broadsheets and manuals are being printed quite voraciously. It would not surprise me in the least.
Yeah, and speaking of that statement you literally just made, obviously you and I are both familiar with Melanchthon's theological writing, but do you know if any of his astrological work has survived?
It's all in Latin, and I've been desperately trying to find good English language translations, and I haven't been able to find any translations of his astrological stuff that into English. They're all kind of still in Latin, and I can't help but think that that's because maybe there's a little worry that if more people knew about his astrological inclinations, that it might somewhat change people's view of him as a theologian. I can't help but think that people are a little hesitant to translate some of that stuff.
Well, reputationally, he's considered an extremely serious and somber figure, right? He's very much a no-nonsense figure of history.
Yep. But, you know, because for him, astrology was not magic, right? It was just a way to track God's plan. And those were different things for him.
Yeah. It was as simple as reading the news, because that's all it was.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. There's been some stuff. People kind of have, mentioned it here and there in terms of historians working today. But really not any good English translations of Melanchthon's specifically astrological work. But he was working on it for years. It was a thing he did all the time. So.
Well, that would be interesting then if someone ever did get around to that project. My Latin exists, but it's not nearly thorough enough to tackle any kind of project like that.
Yeah, I could read it slowly, but to translate it was, whoa.
Just asking I'll have to work for on trouble it. At that point.
Oh, yeah.
Well, all right, man. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about while you were on with us tonight?
That was kind of the big one, man. Reformation, early moderns, very cyberpunk. I think maybe if there's something we could take away from it for our current era.
Yes, that'd be perfect. What are the final
thoughts? Our current era, yeah, some takeaways. I think it's that that chaotic periods in history, like I almost think of where we're at now and the Reformation is almost like sandwich, like a bracket, right? And there's all like the boring modernity in the middle, but at the outmost ends, right? At the very early beginning of modernity and wherever we're at right now, possibly going into something else. It's chaotic. It's scary. Lights in the skies. There's, magical pictures flying around, all kinds of stuff. But, and that can be scary. People obviously in the Reformation did not know what was coming. There was a lot of uncertainty. I think people, at least myself, I've been feeling like that a lot lately. But I guess one way to contextualize that is that, moments of change, they have a lot of bad that happen, but also a lot of good, right? I don't know. I mean, obviously I'm a little biased, but I think that there were some really good things to come out of the Reformation. And so I think it's a little bit of a best of times, worst of times thing. And I guess, people in the early modern period just kind of held on and found meaning in what they were doing and what they believed in. And I think maybe, it's not like a battle plan per se, but I think it's something for us to remember that, like these moments of history come and they go and they come back again. There's a cycle to it all. And it's not the first time it's happened. And so just kind of
sure
maybe stay the course.
The last one either.
No, it won't. No, it won't. Yeah, stay the course. And, hang on. It's going to be a wild ride. So.
All right. Last thing. Is there anything you want to plug or promote while you're here? This is your chance to do some shout outs.
Yeah. You know, if anyone is interested in my highly autistic takes on the early modern or the medieval or literature philosophy, I do have a show, The Wandering Humanists, on YouTube. Released on YouTube for the time being. We might be removed at some point. We'll see. Distinctly kind of we call ourselves Weird Right. Weird Right takes on literature, history, philosophy, religion, things like that. And so if people are interested, we have fun, and more of this kind of insanity happens. So
I think that is what maybe not all of the audience, but a good sized portion of it's looking for. I think that could be right exactly up their alley.
Yeah, well, happy to have anyone stop on by. Let us know what you think. You know, we do it for fun, but we do put a lot of effort into it. We do think a lot. So,
and when they do want to give you feedback, where's the best place to find you?
Twitter, again, for the time being, Twitter is the best place to find me. I'm certain you could type it in a show note there, pause, but it's the @ALTPHILOGE. It's a German word, so Altphilologe. Yeah, so you can find me there. Give me some feedback. I'm happy to hear and happy to field critiques and everything like that. So it's all about the conversation.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. And maybe we'll see about doing this again in the future.
I would love to be back. Thank you again.
All right. You have a nice night, sir.
You too.